Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. That's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this first hour of the show, we'll be talking about health disparities in America. And it's very clear that here in this country, the state of your health will have a great deal to do with who you are, in this sense that minorities in the United States fare much less well than white Americans. They are less likely to have access to regular health care. Minority infants have higher death rates. Minorities have less in the way of life expectancy, and they're at greater risk of developing chronic diseases, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and cancer. The question we try to take up is why this is the case. Why are there racial and ethnic disparities in health? And our guest for the program is Michael Bird. He has now, for many years, been working in the field of public health, in medical social work, in substance abuse prevention, and health promotion and disease prevention. Most recently, he served as director of Region 6 for Native Americans with Value Options New Mexico. This is a national for-profit behavioral health company. Before that, he was executive director of the National Native American AIDS Prevention Center. For 20 years, he was with the U.S. Public Health Service, the Indian Health Service, an agency of the Department of Health and Human Services, and he also served from 2000 until 2001 as president of the American Public Health Association. In fact, he was the first American Indian and the first social worker to serve as president in that history of that organization. He is a Santo Domingo, San Juan Pueblo Indian from New Mexico. He's here visiting the campus. He's here at the bequest and sponsorship of the School of Social Work. And in fact, he'll be giving a talk on this subject, Health Disparities in America 2008, this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the ACES Library Heritage Room. And I believe that it's open to anybody who would like to attend. They would like to get an idea about who might come. So if you can, go to their website, the Social Work website, which is www.socialwork.uiuc.edu, and you can let them know. But otherwise, I'm sure that anyone who is interested in attending the talk should feel welcome. And here on the program, questions are welcome too. 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Anyone's welcome to call. We just ask people to try and keep their comments brief just so we can keep moving along, but it's certainly open to anybody. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Well, David, thank you very much for having me, and I feel like this is a real opportunity to be here at UIC and share some of my thoughts and my experiences and perspectives on health disparities, as well as I think the opportunities I've been fortunate to have in serving as president of the American Public Health Association, which I might add is the oldest and largest and most diverse association of public health workers in the world, about 50,000 members, having had the opportunity to serve as president and first chairman of the board, I think that it demonstrates the American Public Health Association's commitment to equity, diversity, and social justice. You know, as I said, I was the first American Indian president, and that was a wonderful opportunity to bring some attention and some focus on a number of issues that clearly impact American Indian populations, Alaska Native populations, Native Hawaiian communities, but also, I think, to offer some perspectives from a Native perspective on some of the issues that confront this this nation and, sure, in fact, the world. It was, and I'd like to quote Martin Luther King in a very famous and well-known quote, and he said, "Of all forms of inequity, injustice in health care is the most shocking," and which brings us, obviously, to the topic at hand, health disparities. And I'd first like to just say that health disparities, I think probably the best definition is the differences in health status and the impact of diseases on different racial and ethnic populations. And having clearly I think there's the importance of this. I mean, that we are in this nation are confronted by a number of significant issues. You only have to pick up today's paper and look at the price of gasoline, which causes a ripple effect across the economy and a ripple effect across so many things that that we require and need in our daily lives. And all of this sort of funnels down and impacts everyone, but it clearly will impact those who have the least in the way of resources in this nation. In terms of, but specific to the issue that you've mentioned, and why should we be concerned with this? Well, as in 2005, one third of the U.S. population identified themselves as a member of a racial or ethnic minority group. By 2050, this number is expected to be one half of the population of the U.S. And as you know, and many of your listeners, your state is one of the states with a high percentage of racial and ethnic diversity, as is New Mexico, where I come from. I'm not going to go into the specific breakdown, but that population, those communities, suffer significantly when it comes to the demographics of poverty. People of color are more likely to have family incomes less than 200% of the federal poverty level. Over half of Hispanics, African Americans, and American Indians, Alaska Natives are poor or near poor. And over 70% of elderly in these groups are poor or near poor. And I said 70% of the elderly. This all means, with that growing population, that we as a nation need to really move to address that. As they say, an ounce of prevention is versus a pound of cure. And so this is an issue that just is significant. There are many, the causes have been attributed to many things. Clearly, poverty is one of them. Health access, the nature of the patient-physician relationship, our present healthcare delivery system, which is not functioning clearly at the level we need and require. And when you look at it globally, there's some real problems. And as many people in this country, are aware, for all of us, that 45 to 50 million are uninsured or under, and not to mention the underinsured, and that the number one reason for bankruptcy, I believe it still holds given the mortgage crisis and all of that, but the number one reason for bankruptcy is because of a medical condition. It's true that U.S. does have the best equipped hospitals and medical experts, but we spend 16% of our gross domestic product on that, and which is two times the median of in comparison to all industrialized countries. And of course, as we're well aware, we're the only industrialized country that doesn't provide universal health insurance to their people. So all of these factors combined clearly put ethnic and minority populations at continued risk. There's, in terms of the American Indian population, of which I'm familiar and have worked 27 years now, they are considered and have continued to be considered among the poorest in this country. And there was a U.S. Commission on Civil Rights report done in 2003, I believe, which demonstrated that per capita funding by the United States government for American Indians was about the United States government spends more per capita for the medical care for federal prisoners than it does on American Indian populations. And up until this spring, as an example of sort of the marginalized sort of treatment that American Indian populations specifically deal with, it was 8 years before the Congress reauthorized the Indian Health Care Improvement Act. That had been legislation that had been passed, historically passed, and had been up before the Congress for 8 years. And it was not until this spring that they reauthorized that. I might also mention that a very successful and well-proven program of providing health care to urban Indian populations, which are an extremely marginalized and underserved community, the present administration has line item vetoed that funding for the past 2 or 3 years now, and it was only because of the good common sense and the goodwill of the Congress that funding in fact has been restored over the past 3 years now. Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things that's often commented on is the fact that here in the United States, we're actually spending a lot of money on health care per capita, at least compared with other countries, and that in fact, however, if you compare the average health of Americans to people in other countries, We're not getting more for our money. It seems that this, particularly with the populations here we're talking about, is that if we could provide some regular access to just basic kind of care, and if we provided prenatal care to pregnant moms, and if we made sure kids got checkups and got their shots, and as people got older, we were checking their blood pressure and their blood sugar and their cholesterol and trying to give them some basic kinds of health advice, just very routine. We're not talking about anything high tech, just very sort of routine care along the course of the life. But then once people got to be in their adult ages and perhaps then got to be, say, over 40, that if we did those kinds of things, we would cut down on really serious problems later, that if we do have to pay for them, it's going to get more expensive if we wait until the problems are really serious. If we did something up front, it would actually be much more cost effective. But it doesn't seem that argument, that's sort of the old traditional public health argument, and it somehow just doesn't seem to get us very far.
Well, you're absolutely right. And I just want to also speak to what you mentioned, and that the U.S. healthcare system is not the best in terms of quality of care, nor do we lead the world nor are we a leader globally. And there was a recent report by the Commonwealth Fund that spoke to that addressed that issue, and that in 1980, there was the life expectancy we were 14th in life expectancy in the world. Well, in 2007 we dropped down to 29th, and in the area of infant mortality, there are 30 other countries that are ahead of us that take the lead, and not to mention that $1 trillion a year is lost in productivity as it relates to business and that issue. There's also another piece to this, and it's really got a lot of play just this last month, and it was a production of Unnatural Causes, which was a PBS documentary series, and it looked at, they were articulating the fact that in Unnatural Causes that more is determined in terms of health by one's zip code than one's genetic code. Hmm. And in that sense, they speak to the issue of where people live, their environments in terms of clean air, clean water, access to employment, and access to education, access to health care, and that there are significant populations in this country today who, because of where they live and under the conditions they live, are more at risk because of the environment that they live in than, in fact, their genetic coding. I think that we really I think it was and this is one of my favorite quotes, and it seems to – I wish it would grow old and would not ring quite so true. But it's been said that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and expecting a different outcome. And I think in this nation, you know, we already know what needs to be done. We just have to have the social and the political and I think the spiritual sort of willingness to deal with these issues. And another thing that rings true to me is comes from the Bible. Am I not my brother's keeper? And if in fact we were to act in that way and be consistent with that sort of a value, then in fact we would do something different. And in the meantime, because we fail to act, there are people that are dying. There are people who are going without health care. There are people who are suffering. And it is not necessary. It is based on decisions that people make. It is based on action or inaction. And it's unnecessary and a waste of human potential and a waste of our most important resource in this nation. The most important resource, the most valuable resource in this nation, from my perspective, is our people.
So, Let me just, because I want to make sure for anybody who might have just have tuned in, they know who it is that they're talking, they're listening to. Who is this talking right now? Michael Byrd is his name. He's someone who's had spent now over 25 years doing work in public health in the areas of medical social work and substance abuse prevention and health promotion, disease prevention. He, for 20 years, was with the U.S. Public Health Service. He was, for a number of years between 2000 and 2001, the president of the American Public Health Association. And as he mentioned, he's the first Native American, first American Indian, and first social worker to be head of that organization. He's worked in a number of other ways, indeed, other ways working to improve public health in the United States. His academic training is indeed in social work, and he's being hosted here on the campus by the School of Social Work. I'll be talking on this very subject this afternoon on the U of I campus, and it's open to anybody who would like to hear what he has to say. Questions here, welcome to 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have someone here calling on a cell phone from Hoopston on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. Joined the conversation rather late, so let me apologize ahead of time if you've already covered this, but about a million years ago, I received a master's degree in public health from UIC out of Chicago, and I had a professor who was stumping his students, and he said, what's the single biggest factor as far as a marker for your health, public health? What's, you know, what's the single biggest factor? Couldn't figure it out, and of course he said income. It all comes down to how much money you make and where you are on the scale, and sure enough, he was right. Did some work simultaneously as a consultant for the City of Chicago Department of Health for lead abatement, and put a big map of the city on the wall and kind of pinpointed the cases, and sure enough, it normally affected the poorest parts of the city, the south and the west side, the African American and the Hispanic population. So I think your guest is right. We have to do something in this country because there's too many people at the low end of the spectrum that are being left behind, and unfortunately, it all seems to revolve around income. And when you're dealing with public health, that should not be a factor, I believe. I'll go ahead and ring off. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for the comment. I expected you would agree with what the caller had to say.
Yes, I think and I congratulate him on being around a million years, because I think I've been around about the same a length of time. So we should celebrate our birthdays and relish that. But income and education. Education being the other factor, and of course they are related. The more income that one has, typically, and the better education that one has, typically, that reflects better health status of those individuals and those communities. The other thing he talked about was being able to do this mapping, and the mapping that is being done and the research that's really important also clearly identifies the location of stores and people in poorer neighborhoods where they don't have the kind of boutique sort of things that most of us want in terms of fresh fruit and vegetables and that sort of thing, but tend to concentrate on those things that are not as healthy in terms of one's diet. And or there's been research done in terms of looking at the locations of liquor stores and other types of establishments and the selling of tobacco. And there's certain sort of areas in where that is more dominant in certain lower socioeconomic neighborhoods than in other areas. And the whole location of parks and recreation and people being able to get, you know, if your doctor prescribes exercise and people need exercise, and we all do, then people in fact need to have safe environments where they can do that. And clearly, in a number of places in this country today, many urban environments, and I dare say that there are neighborhoods where it is not safe and one does not feel secure. I don't care who you are, even if you're a police officer, probably doing anything in some of these neighborhoods, because you can put yourself at risk.
Yeah. Something, you know, here clearly the bottom line to what we're talking about here is indeed poverty, and that has a great deal to say about your ability to have access to health care. It affects where you live. So it may well be that you're living in a place where environmental hazards are greater. That affects your health. It affects in so many ways. But I want to have you talk about something else that I think is really interesting and perhaps also some people would say controversial, and that is the relationship between doctors and patients. And just as an example, just recently here on the program, a couple of weeks ago, we had a man who was a transplant physician at a Northwestern University Hospital in Chicago who started an Hispanic transplant program because there was this concern, not his or his alone, other people's concern, is that minorities often, because of the kind of chronic health problems that we have talked about, are in need of organ transplant, but that minorities donate less frequently. They seem to be much less comfortable with the idea of organ donation. And he said, well, you know, it seems to make sense that if you can, if people's first language is Spanish, if you can talk with them in Spanish and explain to them the issue and the need for organs, that he found that suddenly people were much more willing to do it. So just being able to have that conversation in people's first language, the one that they're most comfortable in, obviously facilitated communication between the doctor and the patient, because he said you can bring the whole family in, everybody, from the grandmas down to the little kids, and sit them down and say, look, here's what we're talking about. Here's what we want to do. Here's why this is important. What do you think about that? And found that suddenly much more people were willing to be open to the idea of organ donation. So this gets at this idea, if you get a better match between the doctor and the patient, if they're more alike, are they going to communicate better, and that will that better have a better, can you maybe get a better outcome that way? And the reason I say it's controversial is because some people will say, well, you mean that, say, if you have an Indian patient, you should have an Indian doctor, a white doctor couldn't treat an Indian person? And I'm sure you'd say, well, no, that's not what we're saying. But that somehow doctors have to be in tune with their patients, and that may not always be an easy thing if they're coming from different places.
Well, I think there's a body of research and literature that speaks to the fact that the whole notion of linguistic competency and culturally appropriate and cultural competency speaks to that very issue. The more you have in common with someone, or a common frame of reference, I think the more effective one will be. And I think it's been pretty well established that, I mean, if you can't communicate with a patient and they can't communicate with you, well, you've got a problem. Mm-hmm. But it's more sophisticated than that, from the standpoint of having at least an appreciation and respect for the cultural sort of. As a diverse nation, we are a very diverse nation. And does that mean we have to, sort of have that framework for everyone? But I think the point is that one would hopefully recognize their limitations, because we all have limitations. And given our training, given our experience, given what we've raised, all we can know is what we've experienced. Mm-hmm. I think, unfortunately, sometimes in some professional areas, though, there's a tendency to assume that make the assumption that everyone will understand me, or that I understand everything. There's a quote that I use that keeps me in a frame of mind to be open to things, and it was by Will Rogers, a Cherokee Indian, a humorist back in the 40s and 50s, and he said, "We're all ignorant. Just about different things," and I think that physicians, healthcare providers, everyone can sort of assume that they know more than they really do, and I think it as professional people, it really falls on us to be clear on what not only what our strengths are, but what our limitations are, and when we need to reach out and engage others in a community to do the work. One real quick example, in Santo Domingo Pueblo, where I come from, it's a very conservative community, have their own language, history, have been there, they would say, since the beginning of time. And the discussion of cancer was not an issue that people could even begin to deal with, and much less people in the healthcare system, any health service or anyone else for that matter. And that community was turned around by one individual who was an Indian woman, Mary Lovato, who's a nationally recognized leader in cancer education. She was a cancer survivor, and she single-handedly raised that level, the level of awareness of cancer and cancer as an issue in that community, to take it from one where she was shunned when she first got her diagnosis over a period of time, where the community embraced her and the tribal leadership and supported her and encouraged her work. And those are things that it took somebody who was from the community, who knew the values, knew the traditions, and knew the language, who could single-handedly in some respects, although a number of us supported her and encouraged her along the way, but changed the attitudes of that specific community to be more open and more supportive and encouraging of people in that community that of cancer in a way that external systems, Indian Health Service, any of those other systems external to that community, they couldn't even do that. Mm. So we have to be aware of the fact, what are our limitations, and when do we engage the community who might be more effective and better at reaching that community, that population, than we would be.
Mm. I think that also points at an interesting idea, and one probably we don't know as much about as we should, and that is that there are real ways that culture determines what you think it means to be well, what you think it means to be sick, and what you do about that.
Absolutely. And this is something that is I've found rather interesting and amusing in the 25 years that I've been in this work, is that the whole notion of holistic health is not really a Western concept. The whole notion of holistic health really comes from indigenous, to the best of my knowledge and my study, comes from indigenous communities. Mind, body, spirit comes from indigenous philosophy and indigenous values and beliefs, and out of the Orient. Mm-hmm. But it's not a Western concept. It's sort of, if given sort of in the past 15 years now, I guess, where it's sort of caught on, you would think that somebody invented it. I invent this concept. The fact of the matter is most of these concepts and ideas have come from other cultures, other populations and communities. And some of the practices, I mean, it was not that long ago acupuncture and chiropractic sort of practice were discouraged and not embraced and not recognized and not valued. And now we see that sort of really has kind of, I think, turned around, and that we now acknowledge that there are many ways of understanding and treating people's conditions.
We are a little bit past our midpoint here, and I have a couple callers I want to get right to. But again, for the benefit of anybody who might have just tuned in, I'd like to introduce again our guest, Michael Byrd. He is a Santo Domingo San Juan Pueblo Indian. He makes his home in New Mexico. He has more than 25 years of public health experience in a number of areas: medical social work, substance abuse prevention, health promotion, disease prevention. He served as executive director of the National Native American AIDS Prevention Center. He was for 20 years with the U.S. Public Health Service. He was with the Indian Health Service. He was president of the American Public Health Association and was the first American Indian and first social worker to serve as president in the history of that organization. He's been involved in many health disparities projects and programs on many levels, local, tribal, national, international. And he's here visiting the campus, being hosted by the folks in the School of Social Work, and he'll be talking on this very subject here, Health Disparities in America 2008, this afternoon on the campus of the University of Illinois. This talk will be in the ACES Library Heritage Room. It is free and open to the public. They'd kind of like to get an idea how many people might show up, so if you can, RSVP for them. The easiest way to do that probably is to go to their website. That's the website of the School of Social Work, www.socialwork.uiuc.edu. And I'm sure they'd be happy. Anybody who would like to stop in and hear what Michael Byrd has to say, I'm sure that they would say you are welcome. And here on the program, of course, callers are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Line one is next. Someone in Gibson City.
Yes, hello.
Yes.
I just want to thank you, and I'm glad you're on the program. I guess you've kind of hit on the question of cultural differences, and I think that culture is a big part of how we deal with things, and we really, I think, in the white world have to educate ourselves to the Native American culture. An example is my mother comes from the Red Lake Chippewa Band up in Minnesota, and she married a white man and lived off the reservation, so I grew up in a white world. But one thing I always admired about my relatives, when somebody got sick, aunts and uncles and everybody went to the hospital, and of course this was different, and one of the things the hospital up there did was, in Bemidji, was they realized that there was a difference, and so they got together and they made allowances for Native American families to come as a group, you know, because in the hospital it's like two visitors at a time and that. So I thought that would just bring to mind of an example of the differences in how you know, the cultures are in relating to an illness. And I also have a question for you. Our daughter is graduating with a degree in family practice in June, and she's thinking of going into health service, and I just want your ideas on, talk a little bit about Indian health service, and I'll hang up and listen, and again, thank you.
All right. Go ahead.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the warm response and the welcome to your part of the world. For me, I tend to be candid, and that's probably why I'm in career choices. I'm sort of been independent and a consultant. I think that the Indian Health Service has done some incredibly good work and very difficult work since it was established in the 50s. It also faces some real challenges. I would say for me, and everybody's experience is different, and I'll just leave it at this. That for me, career-wise, it's where I really learned about what the issues were in my community and Indian communities, and it's also where I really learned to understand government and bureaucratic systems, both the strength and the weaknesses inherent in those systems. I think I would describe it as it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. But for everyone, it's a different experience. I would say that if she wants to understand what the issues are impacting Indian populations and Indian communities, that's the place to start. But I also would encourage her and to be open to other sorts of opportunities. I think one of the things that we as Indian people need to do is be willing to step outside of things that we know are oftentimes more comfortable with. For me, the one thing I would encourage her to do was establish relations with professional associations. For me, the American Public Health Association has become my home, and because it is an environment that in my experience, by and large, has been open to issues and concerns of Indian populations and has made a sincere effort to be consistent with its values of equity, diversity, social justice. I would encourage her to cast a wide net and then to follow her heart, and things will work out just fine, I'm sure.
All right. Let's talk with someone next in Champaign. This is line two. Hello.
Thank you. Forgive me if you've already covered this. I tuned in a little late. But not too long ago, T.R. Reid had a program on PBS where he basically went and looked at the national health care systems in England, Germany, Japan, and I believe Taiwan, where I don't remember if there were others besides that, but I know he did focus on those. And, you know, basically compared them to the United States and to each other. And, you know, talked about the cost and their health outcomes. And as I did hear you say, you know, I mean, we're way down the list and far below all of those countries, both in outcome and in cost. But the one thread that went through all those different countries that he went and looked at was that they took profit out of the equation and, you know, had a single-payer type system. They were all different, but you know, I think the real problem we're facing in this country is the power of the private insurance and private pharmaceutical companies and their corrupting influence on our political system. And I think that is really why we don't have a national health care system, and it's going to be the real roadblock to getting one.
I appreciate your question. I was just listening to Bill Moyers last night on PBS, and he has just published a book, and I didn't get the title of it. But I think a big thesis, a contention for him, is exactly the point that you've made, is that the real ability of Americans, you know, average, hardworking Americans, to influence and to develop policy, social policy, public policy that really better meets the needs of the citizenry of this nation, is in fact is not working in the way that it was established, and that in fact, I may be putting words into his mouth, but this is the way I read it. That in fact, the process has been hijacked. And it's been hijacked by corporations who have profit, whose bottom line is profit. It's been hijacked by corporations who, in fact, who are beholden to their stockholders, but first and foremost, and not the citizens of this nation. And I think that might, Bill Moyers' book might make an interesting read. It was. Bill, he's very, very well established and credible, I believe.
One more point in regards to the earlier talk about income level and health, and I'm sorry I can't remember the doctor who did the comparative study, but looked at income and health of populations between countries, and it was very interesting that it found that countries that had a smaller spread between the low end and high income, not only were the poorer people healthier, but the richer people were healthier too. In other words, rich people in countries where there wasn't such a big gap between the top and the bottom in income, the rich people were healthier than rich people here in the United States, where there was, this big income gap. And I just find that very interesting correlation. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Let's continue. We'll talk with another caller here. This is someone also in Champaign, and this is line 3. Hello?
Yep. Is that me?
Yeah.
Looking at this wonderful community that we have here, which is in the state, as far as I can tell, the highest income and the lowest income spread among its population. Why is it that we attempt to say that we have health care available for everybody when even with Medicare or aid or what have you, a poor person can't afford the time to recover from whatever assistance is given, which, as far as I'm concerned, is assistance and aid to dependent doctors. I would make two suggestions, both of which are not acceptable. One is that all alcohol-related difficulties be supported entirely by the alcohol industry, be it restaurants or distributors or what have you, and that the government be the supplier of all recreational drugs, so that if people are stupid enough to want to use them, they have the option of very happily wiping themselves out.
I'm not sure how one can respond to such a thing. I guess it does, though, bring us back to the issue of access to health care and that being related to income. And what I think many people have argued for a long time now is that we need a very significant and very dramatic kind of change in how health care is delivered in the United States. And that's the only way that we're really going to be able to address the kind of disparities that we're talking about. At the same time, I guess I'd say, well, we've been talking about this now for I don't know how long, and nothing has changed very much. I wonder, you know, can you at all be optimistic? Assuming you think that that would be a good thing, that all optimistic about at all optimistic about things changing, even if, for example, we'd have someone different in the White House. Yeah.
Well, one has to hold on to one's optimism. I think it was I'm reminded of a quote by Sir Winston Churchill, the Prime Minister of England, who said Americans are in effect, Americans are great at doing the right thing after they've exhausted every other possibility. I think that for me that rings true. I don't know how many other people that sort of resonates with, but the other thing I think is sort of about human nature and how people change when they want to or they have to. And I think one of the examples we see clearly is a very real one is how the whole discussion of global warming and how now that seems to have people are beginning to understand, recognize, appreciate that in fact it is an issue. In spite of some people holding on to some other sort of another opinion and perspective on that, the reality is that people are slowly, and if you want to really get depressed, let's look at that and what the implications that might have, not only in terms of health, but just survival, and of course. As one has pointed out, someone else has pointed out, you know, the world will do just fine. It might not be any people around, but the world will be fine because it'll continue in some form or fashion. Mm-hmm. Human beings may come to an end, but that is, I think, something to ponder, and I'll leave it at that.
Yeah. Well, obviously here we have a problem in that the system of healthcare delivery we have has been like it has been for some time. There are a lot of people who are invested in it, and there probably are also significant numbers of Americans who probably say, well, I think it's as far as I'm concerned, it's just fine. So changing the entire system, this would not be an easy thing. It's not the kind of thing that you can accomplish quickly. So some people have said, well, maybe the thing to do is to chip away at it. Now, I know other people would say, no, that's not the way to do it. But the most realistic thing, they'd say, well, let's look at the most underserved groups and try to deal with their needs first. So that's why we have people saying, well, let's start with children. Let's at least say, okay, we'll try and make sure that all children in America, no matter what their background, no matter what their economic situation, they have access to health care. And then maybe from there you start to go, okay, well then let's look at the poorest adults and sort of work our way up. What do you think of that? Is that realistically, you think, the way that it's going to have to work? That is, start with where the greatest need is, which probably is with children, and then see if we could cover all kids and then go on from there?
Well, let me just mention something that I think speaks to that, and that also, thank God for PBS and Bill Moyers. But last night he was mentioning that 63%, and I guess most recent surveys, that 63% of the population of this nation believe that we need some sort of national health care. Mm-hmm. So that is, 63%, that is really a significant number of people. I wish I had an answer in terms. I think I think it's going to be an incremental sort of process, unless there's some sort of major crisis that would prompt one Congress and the people in this nation to really rise up and really demand that. But you know, it also flies in the face of the fact that I think Moyers was saying we're spending $12 billion. It's not that we don't have the resources; it's just how we're using them. And Bill Moyers pointed out that we're spending $12 billion a month on this war in Iraq. And also the nation has clearly indicated in most polls that people are opposed to that and would prefer that in some form or fashion that end. And so It is that that is a very perplexing sort of issue, but I think it goes back to really, you know, you can get caught up in all of this. In either we value and support and believe in the right of people to have health care or not. For me, that's what it boils down to, and then we act on it. And when we fail to act on it, people are also making a choice, and they're making a choice, and it's being put on the and people are suffering more high mortality, high morbidity. And I'd like to just raise mention an article that just was in the American Journal of Public Health in March by Dr. Stephen Kunitz. It's called "Changing Patterns of Mortality Among American Indians," and he did research on the funding levels in recent history. And his final statement was that, "I argue that inadequate funding for health services contributed significantly to the increased death rate of American Indians." And I would say that that's the sort of experience that the rest of the nation is having and is beginning to really understand, is that if you do not put resources and provide resources for appropriate care, you, in fact, we are losing people. People are dying. People are going without services, and people are getting sicker, and it's costing us more. And our leadership, and we need to be speaking to our leadership and our political constituencies, and making it really clear to them that this healthcare is a right. And it's been pointed out way too many times already, and with no movement on this, is that all the congressional, all our congressional representatives have health care. And they need not worry about that. Mm. It's the rest of us that have to worry about it.
It's really clear for you that this field that you work in, public health and promotion of public health, it's really clear that you're very passionate about this. I'm curious if you would forgive a personal question. How it is that you made the choice to go into the field? Or when did you decide that you wanted to be a social worker and have that be your field?
My cross to bear or whatever. and I don't mind personal questions, because if I don't want to answer, I just say no.
Well, but
no,
yeah, fine.
No, I'm fine. I'm being facetious. I started out in a family with a single mother who went to the seventh grade, who supported myself and my sister, who worked long and hard and was fortunate to end up in a good position. I was blessed with a mother. Mother's Day coming up, Mom, thank you, love you, God bless you. If it wasn't for you, all the good things that have happened would not have happened. But I also had it was a mixed blessing, because my father, God bless him, was an alcoholic, and his whole life had a major issue with alcohol, and eventually died of cirrhosis of the liver. And I think at some point early on, I was very aware on levels that way beyond my years, of just how difficult that situation and that circumstance was for me, and recognized that there were many other people. And at that time, I thought it was just Indian people, because I thought Indian people were the only one that had problems. And needless to say, I've come to appreciate the fact that everybody's got problems, just different kinds of problems. And actually, I might be able to help out my white brother, sister, my African brother and sister, my Hispanic brother and sister, my Asian brother and sister, in terms of struggling with some of the challenges that we all face. And that is the whole nature of the human experience, and unfortunately suffering being a part of it, and loss and all of those things. So I've come to understand and appreciate that. And I guess the only thing I ever wanted to do was to try and be helpful and do something good, because I've been so blessed.
We're real short on time, like we have a minute or so left. I guess just one other thing I'm really interested in is whether you think that, in fact, we might get back to a greater appreciation for the importance of public health and all of those things that surround people in their lives that determine their health, that may influence personal choices, that may have nothing to do with personal choices. It seems to me, if you look back in the history of health, Sure, drugs are good and penicillin's great and CAT scans are fine. But the biggest things that changed health outcomes in this country were things like being able to give people clean water and and sanitation systems and, you know, those sorts of things that had nothing to do with shots and pills and fancy machines, you know. And it seems that we've gotten away from the whole idea of public health.
Well, I agree with you. I think I also think that there's another piece of that, and it really goes back to and not from but from a spiritual standpoint of people being at peace with themselves and with their families and with the world, and having a sense of hope and believing that, that tomorrow will be better than today. And I think that some of that in the world that we live in today, given gas prices and food prices and shrinking economy and mortgages and all of that, it really is, I think, a challenge and a struggle to maintain some sense of tranquility and peace within oneself. But that's, I think, if you do not have that within yourself, how can you sort of promote that anywhere?
Yeah. Well, for people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to hear more from our guest, Michael Byrd, he's here visiting the campus. His visit sponsored by the School of Social Work. He'll be giving a talk on health disparities in America 2008 this afternoon at 4 o'clock in the ACES Library Heritage Room. It's free and open to the public. He has now more than 20 years been working in the areas of medical social work and health promotion and disease prevention. He was from 2000 until 2001 the president of the American Public Health Association, as we've mentioned, the first American Indian, first social worker ever to be head of this organization. Thanks very much for being here.
Appreciate it.